I'm going to call the meeting. We'll call this meeting to order. Good afternoon, everyone. It's Tuesday, August 1st, 2023. It is 1:07 p.m. Thank you. This is the meeting of the Commission on Housing Affordability. We are a subcommittee of the Utah Unified Economic Opportunity Commission. We oversee housing affordability on behalf of that commission. So welcome all of you here. I'm pleased to be joined by my co-chair, Representative White, and several members of the commission. We welcome everyone who's in the audience as well, and there's plenty of bundt cake here for everyone. We're going to skip approval of the minutes for technical reasons, so we'll move on to item two, public comment. Do we have any public comment from anyone who's at the meeting today that would like to share their thoughts with us? Seeing none, do we know if there's anyone online? No, and nothing was submitted in writing. Okay. Then next, we are on to item four, AMI deficit. We'll hear from Dion Essick. Thank you, sir. And I'll turn your microphone on.
Thank you.
And you'll turn your computer on, and we'll be set. All right.
Can you see my?
Since you're on screen, maybe they just want you to turn your computer around this way.
Yeah. Can I hold it up?
Yeah, there you go.
What? I can't run it directly from a computer. Give me 1 second. Is it the CAP net?
That'll do.
Okay.
That's the public one.
Let me borrow your microphone. Janice and Dina, do you want to go over a little bit high level on the data material and have that discussion while Dayan's getting set up?
Sure, we can do that. I think. Because I don't think we have any slides, do we? Are we showing slides, Christina?
No, we do not.
Okay. Is Janice? Janice, are you on the call? Are you in the room? Okay, I guess you just get me. So Janice Kimball and I'm delighted to be co-chairs of the data working group within CHA, and we're working on a couple of things. Primarily, it's a continuation of the work that's already been started from last year with Jahan at Kim Gardner Policy Institute and Christina with regard to looking at supply, demand, and projection models. So that's going to continue. So in terms of sort of any requests we have for CHA, that's it. Continue this work. It's important. And we're, as Christina can mention and Jahan can mention, still working through it. It's going to take a little bit of time, but we're already seeing some really excellent initial results of that and some opportunities about how this data is going to be able to inform the decisions that we'll be making about affordable housing in our various communities. Another sort of issue that came up that we wanted to talk about are these access to opportunity maps, access to, you know, to employment opportunities and things like that. Wasatch Front Regional Council is one of the leaders in this world and has some excellent examples. I see Bert sitting in the audience. That elicited a smile from you. I'm delighted. Because he, you know, all of you know, he's won some national recognition for the work he does, and it is rightly deserved. And he's really been helping kind of a data sub-working group thinking about how those access to opportunity maps can really be beneficial for communities in making decisions. So the second request that the Data Working Group has for CHA is to support our continued efforts to continue to develop these resources for various size cities and to begin to help cities put together a series of questions that could help them define a case for use of these resources. The other benefits that this sort of subgroups work is doing is talking about data standardization, cleaning up data. How are we presenting the data to make sure that it's usable and accessible across many platforms and for many different sized communities, depending on the internal resources they may have. So we're continuing to work on that. And then I think those were the two big ones. Christina, did I miss anything? Or Janice, if she's able to join us?
Let me just read through some of the topics in a little bit
more detail.
Thank you. And then Dayan will be ready to present. So material that we've been working on as a group is gathering the housing needs supply and demand database for AMIs 80, 60, 50, and 30. We've been working on a GIS layer for economic opportunity and transportation access with BERT and some other folks. We're looking at collecting as much data as we possibly can before the session starts. The universe of housing funding opportunities and programs in the state. This has been a little bit more tricky than we initially thought it would be. So we will have as much data as we can gather, again, by the session, and then we'll continue the effort into the upcoming year. We are also looking at entitled land, but that may be something that is a study item for next year as well. Again, that is a little bit more difficult. We don't have anything in legislation that provides the opportunity for people to provide us that specific data. So it's reaching out to individuals and asking for specific GIS layers, which again is a little too complicated for right now. And then we are also going to be looking at the for sale product by AMI in the current marketplace. So with that, Dayan has the a new report on missing units at certain AMIs, as well as he's going to give you an example of what the database is.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Things are working. Thank you for your patience.
Thanks, Christina.
All right. Well, thank you all for having me here today, and it's been a fun and scary journey. The numbers I'm going to share with you today are a little bit dramatic, but I think they're important to grasp, and they're a little bit more dramatic than what we're used to hearing from some of the national sources. And there's several reasons, and if you're interested, we can go into depth as to why, but primarily it's data sources and methodology and geography of what it really comes down to. So what I want to go through, first off, I want to go through just some of our high-level findings from all of this data work that we've compiled over the last over the last year. It's already been a year. And then looking at how can we use what we've come up with as a launching point, as a baseline to further improve metrics and KPIs and other variables that this group and others might be interested in. So first, I'm going to go over the deed restricted supply database. This is a compiled database of units that have a deed restricted with affordability targets associated to them. Then we're going to go move into this rent affordability deficit that we've calculated for every city over 5,000 residents across the state. And so we've covered a lot of our geography, and all of this data, we can go from city up to county and up to state. And then we'll look at some home ownership challenges. Before I begin, just what I've learned through this process is summing up data to a state level is a bit misleading, because we have a surplus in Beaver County, but we have a deficit in Cache County. They can rule each other out. In reality, they can't help each other out because of geographical or distance, right? So I think we need to look at this from a more granular level other than the state would be my recommendation. So moving into our deed restricted supply currently, There's roughly 33,000 units that have some sort of deed restrictions on them. And if we look at the unit composition, about 45% of them are either studio or one bedroom serving, you know, lower occupancy households, and two bedroom represent about 37%, and three or more make up about 18% of the affordable housing stock. So our next iteration of this is to drill down into demands by housing size, because we know just from literature that really the vulnerabilities are single parent households. And so part of our work, our next step too, is doing a survey with our 18 housing authorities to better understand what their needs are based on the population trends that they're seeing come through their door. Where are these units located? About 18,000 of them are in Salt Lake County, and it's a dramatic drop off for the rest of the counties. But primarily concentrated along the Wasatch Front would make up majority, probably 60% of them. What can we learn? What populations do these units serve by AMI? You can see as we get down into the lower AMI, the 30s and the 20s, there's really a low percentage of units there. So part of what I'm going to share today is when we start at 80%, the deficit gets dramatically lower and lower as we move down the income stream. Another thing that this helps us is address is when do these units expire, so we could be strategic, whether it's with preservation funds or stuff like that, where money needs to go. So these units are, I think, much more cheaper to preserve rather than to build new affordable housing. So this helps us be more strategic. And we have this by building level. We can parse however we want this data. So moving on to affordability imbalance. So where we start is with the county's AMI, area median income set by HUD. We put the rent thresholds at 30% of incomes, but for different income groups. Okay. And again, I really want to drive this point home. It's the importance of geography and geographical imbalance. So if we just look at it at the state level, we summarize everything. We have approximately 230,000 units. If we go from left to right, 80 AMI and below, so that includes everything, 60, 50, and 30, right? So this is a cumulative number. How many households we have how many housing units we have available that meet the rent threshold set by HUD, okay, in each one of these income categories. So then we look at households in this blue bar. So we look at 80 AMI and below, there's virtually no deficit. But you could see at every single level later by AMI, that blue bar exceeds, the household number exceeds the number of units available. So we have these deficits. So at 60% and below AMI, we have an affordability deficit of about 68,000 units. When we get down all the way to 30, it's about 77.
Wrong button. So here's my question for you. So AMI varies depending on household size.
Yes. And county.
Yeah. And do we have a sense about, so what's that, 250 or so thousand? 230,000?
Yeah, on 80%. Yeah.
Well, I just, between all three of those. Right?
Yeah.
So do we have a sense about the household size?
Yeah.
In among those 230,000?
Yeah, we can get that out. Right now, our goal was just to get to this point, and now we're going to drill down on each county's household size. So we can drill that further. So that is an important aspect of this as well. When we move this number to a geography, so same level, 30, 50, 60, 80, but we break it out by county, it's no surprise that all the issues are across the Wasatch Front and in southwest part of the state. And this is the problem of summarizing data at a county level. So, you know, being strategic of looking at it by, we have it by city, but also looking at it by county because Salt Lake County's deficit is not helped by Beaver County's surplus, right? Well, it could be if you want to drive that far, but that's for you guys to hash out. So another way to look at this as well is what's the availability of affordable rental units per 100 households? And so we can see at 80 AMI and below, we're pretty much one for one. There's no deficit. And as we get lower and lower, that deficit gets further and further across the state. For if you look at the 30%, there's only 3 units available for every 100 renter households that are at that income level. And so same as we break this out, metric out by county, we see that deficit for 30% AMI and below. It's severe across the state. And as we get further up the income stream, the deficit gets a little better. But again, it's about geographic concentration that's really important to look at these numbers. Also looking at affordability for homeownership. So I shared this graph with some of you probably my last time here, but when we look at share of renters that cannot afford the median priced home throughout early this year, 9 out of 10 renters could not afford the median priced home. Okay. So keeping in mind those metrics from the earlier slides on AMI.
Can I make a complaint about this statistic?
Sure. Of course.
So what we're saying here is that I guess this is all renters, so maybe my complaint is not applicable here. But when we say that people at the, you know, in the bottom decile of income cannot afford a home at the 50th percentile of housing, that's not necessarily a problem. Because there's half of the houses are below that cost, right? So you're saying they can't afford the up,
just the median,
the half or above. It would be much more meaningful to get the statistic of can they afford housing at a lower price point, and what is the deficit there, rather than the median, which I it just strikes me that would be
so. Senator, you're my plant for this presentation. I have that answer for you in the next slide.
If you back up one slide.
One more.
Yeah, back up. I think I understand. I want to make sure I understand. I think what this slide is intending to show us is on the left, if your income level is 80% of average median income, depending on where you live, that you could find the market is such that you could find a place to rent and only spend 30% of your income.
Statewide.
Okay. Yeah.
This is a statewide metric.
That's in the aggregate.
Yeah, that's in the aggregate. And
on the right is 80%. So there are a handful of counties where you could pick and choose, and there's a few counties where you're going to struggle a bit.
Yeah, correct.
On the left, 30% below, there is, and some counties have it. Salt Lake has a surplus. Is that 95 on the right on AMI?
No, it has a deficit. So it's 5 units short to have a 100 to 100 match. So if we look at 100 renter households, there are 95 units available for them that are affordable.
Yeah, when I was teaching at Mountville High School, they'd hire a new teacher out of BYU, and he'd commute for half a year trying to find a place he could afford on a beginning teacher's salary.
Yeah.
I think they'd end up I don't know where they end up now, but they'd find a place in Clearfielder. But that was 30 years ago. Who knows what it looks like today. Thanks. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
So I'll jump up to here. And Senator Fillmore, to your question, home ownership specifically by AMI, when we looked at every sales transaction off the MLS in 2022 and assigned, you know, monthly mortgage payment, taxes, et cetera, and took those income thresholds and applied it to that mortgage. So in 2022, 6.2% of the 40,000+ homes that sold were affordable to 80% AMI. Okay, only 2.4 for 60 and below and et cetera. And again, geography matters here a little. What was that?
Well, you can go on with your geography matters and then I'll ask my question.
Okay. And so geography matters as well here. So if we look to the far left of this chart, we'll see, you know, Utah Cache, Box Elder, Tooele, Washington, Davis, Salt Lake, et cetera, our main population centers. All of them are less than 10% are affordable to 80% of AMI. Mm-hmm. Okay, so.
So how many people are at 80% of AMI as a percentage of the total population?
So as households, roughly 20%.
Okay, and how many are at 60%? As we look at that statistic, we see there's 6% that's going to 80% of AMI. We're like, wow, that's a 74% gap. But it's really like a 14% gap if what you just said is true, right? Like 20% of households are at this income level,
yeah,
and 6% of the home sales were. So yeah, there's still a gap.
Yes.
But it's a gap of 14% of the population, not 74% of the population.
Yeah, and part of this is focusing on renters specifically, okay, right? If you're a homeowner, other than your property taxes going up slightly.
Yeah. Okay, sure. If you already owned your home,
yeah,
you know, maybe and, about 3 or 4 years ago.
Right.
Okay.
And so it's really about addressing these renter obstacles that are...
To me, it would be very helpful to have that statistic, okay, as part of it, just as we're trying to figure out what
just
is the scale of the problem.
Population.
Okay, so 80, 60, and 30.
Yeah.
How many families or how many households are we talking about at the 80, 60, and okay, 30 level and be able to compare those with actual numbers?
Okay.
Okay.
We'll make that adjustment. Thank you. So really in closing, you know, it's a geographic focus. What we're seeing in the market this year is declining construction activity by roughly 25 to 30%. That's going to persist until the monetary and fiscal policy work itself out on the macro level. So we expect the housing shortage to continue, and that in itself will continue to put upward pressures on housing costs. So that's my positive takeaway.
Yep. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So
go ahead. You got more?
I'll share just real quickly just some of our dashboards. And again, I invite everybody's feedback. How do we utilize this more productively, and how we can really get the best bang for our buck? So when it uploads, this is our housing supply database. So we can select it by any city that has a deed restricted property in it across the state, and we can get some great metrics on unit availability, or excuse me, composition of units, when do they expire, and then at an individual property level, when do they expire. I think really focusing on what population they serve and when they expire is real. We have this ability now, and we'll work with Christina how to make this accessible and more public. So And just real quick, our other database, if I can pull it up here. So we have this at the city level. I'm showing this by county level, so we don't put any city on the spot here. But for example, this is for Davis County, just looking at some of the housing composition. So we have rent limits that are set, but really we could break this out now by what share of units are available by different AMIs down here at the bottom left. What is that affordable units per 100 renter households availability, and then the actual cumulative shortage by different AMI groups. So we can see, for example, in Davis County that there is not a deficit at 80% AMI, but there is as we get further down the AMI stream. So, you know, so please tell me how we can make this better, because I get too into the weeds with it, and send me all of your questions that you want answered, and we'll see how many we can answer them. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Other than the questions I've already asked, you know, we often hear the statistic that, you know, people at this level of income can't afford the median mm-hmm. house. And what I'd be more interested in knowing is like, okay, if 80% or below is 20% of the population,
okay,
can they afford houses at the 20th percentile, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning 20% of the housing stock is also under that level, right?
Yeah.
That, to me, is a much more meaningful okay. statistic if we're trying to solve a problem.
I agree.
If we're trying to make expensive houses affordable, to, like that's, I just think the other one is
okay.
a fairly meaningless statistic.
Okay, thank you. We'll adjust.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? I don't see anybody online. Nicholas.
Yeah, thank you for putting this report together. It's great. You called for comments on things that might be helpful. The breakdown by county is incredible. Thank you so much for doing that because we lose so much in the net.
Mm-hmm.
One additional request, and if you had a slide on this and I missed it, I apologize, is can we show the cumulative deficit number so we don't lose the total deficit in the net? Does that make sense? We need to show the total number of deficit, not net of the overages in some counties.
Yeah, we can put all the negatives together.
Great. Thank you. Everything else looks, this is powerful. And I'm going to make a quick comment. That deficit and that net really kind of drowns out two of our biggest counties, Salt Lake and Utah. As you look at that 80% AMI, I just want to make sure we don't forget that those two counties together combined for over 5,000 shortage in households in the AMI. So as we look at the net, you may think, oh, we don't have an 80% problem, but the two counties with their largest populations actually have a significant deficit. So this, what you've done here is helpful. It's illustrative. So thank you.
Thank you.
Wayne Niederhauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to piggyback on Senator Fillmore's question or request, I just want to be clear. So when we're talking about the cumulative rental deficit, there was a chart given to us in for this meeting. Now this information was presented in the slides. But we're not dealing with median households when we're looking at, I'm just going to take 30% AMI. Housing units available, 2,412. Households that are in that category, 79,552. Deficit, 77,140. Isn't that pretty straightforward there? We're not dealing with any medians in there. That's just, these are households that are in 30% AMI. This is the inventory that we have.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. A question. Just wanted to clarify so I understand what we're doing.
Are those 77,000 people all looking for housing or are some of them already in housing? Is that number of housing, is that the housing that's available and on the market, or does that include the entire stock?
That includes the entire stock.
Okay.
Well, we don't have 77,000 people that are homeless.
right. So,
they're in housing some way, I guess.
So I just want to reiterate, typically we talk about this housing shortage. What we're talking about here is the affordability shortage, right? The lack of affordable housing. These people still have housing. It's just their housing costs are much greater than 30% of their income.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Representative Briscoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not trying to give you Excedrin headache number or whatever.
That's okay.
And I've been in on the calls and I've been in on the CHA subgroup calls in which we've discussed, ask a lot of questions about how do we put data together that's helpful?
Mm-hmm.
We can gather a bunch of data. Is this helpful to us? And I understand why we're using median income. I'm trying to have a better understanding. What the chair was talking about, we have this county, we have this city, and here's their income structure, this many people making this much money, and we're focusing on people below, 80% below. Instead of using the median income, do we need to know something about the housing, about what homes are being sold for and how many are on the market. And that's a moving number. Any given MLS is going to be different in any given day, and median home price is going to change.
Right.
Because in some parts of Summit County, the median home price is going to be significantly different, and it's going to be significantly different than Salt Lake County, and parts of Salt Lake County are going to be significantly different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, so
you pointed out the geography difference. You can't just take the state as a whole, focus on an area you're interested in. And in some places with more transportation, like Salt Lake County, you probably want to draw a radius.
Mm-hmm.
Someone might live in this spot in the county, and they might have transportation possibilities that extend out this many miles. The problem is if you're in Bainbridge, or if you're in Moab and you get hired as a fireman or a teacher or a nurse, where do you go to find housing within X miles? How many miles do you have to drive if it's not within, you know, within a couple of miles of Moab? I mean, what do we need to know about the housing stock in a particular area to make sense?
Yeah, so just peeling it back a little bit. So when we start with the median income from HUD, we estimate how many households are along the 30%, right? We then take those thresholds on their affordability, and then we apply it to, you know, we get data basically every month of stuff that's available on the market, right? So we're estimating these housing costs in real time. You're never going to be able to hit the bullseye on a dartboard, but the goal is to get as close as we can, is the best way I can put it. So again, this is really step one of our process and research and development. So we're going to get better with it as we just fine tune this. But again, you know, data availability on housing costs is really challenging. So.
On the glasses half full side, we've been up here several years, some of us, and we've been asking for this data. And to actually be able to see this and even to this level of detail is
thank you.
Is great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Nicholas, you had another question?
Yeah, again, just another comment. And I don't know if this is possible to incorporate, but and this is Claudia O'Grady had this question. I'm going to build on what her question is. Did that data reflect households that are living in the correct AMI unit? So does that show a household in a 50% AMI band living in a 50% AMI unit? And if not, that could be helpful. We find commonly in the market that an 80% household will stay in their 50% AMI unit, as well as a 30% household that can get into an 80% AMI unit and is actually paying 60 to 70% of their annual income towards rent.
Yeah. We have no direct way of tracking individuals' households' rent, but we do track the rent of units. So we capture the rents directly, but not the households.
Okay. Sounds like I'm just watching Claudia kind of post some things here, and maybe Dave, I can leave this to you, but it sounds like maybe UHC might track that, and they might be able to help there as well. I just bring it up because there's kind of this shadow market of people living in incorrect units that can falsely impact what we might see as supply or demand for those units.
Yeah, and just for a quick clarification, UHC and our office with PAB and Olean, we do track that particular data set on a sample level, though. Other housing units that are deed restricted, we're not in the business of kicking people out, but yes, there are definitely cases that we have already seen where the income is significantly more than 100% AMI, and they're still using these units. So,
but what we've got here is a wonderful start. This is incredible. I reiterate, by county is hugely illustrative. Thank you.
And we do have it by city, just to be clear. We're just not showing that right now. As we refine the data a little bit more, then we will be able to have it drilled down to cities with a population of 5,000 or more.
And thank you. That's all the questions I see. All right. Dan, thank you so much. That was great. We're moving on to working group updates. So our first update will be from the funding side. on our working group. And I know we have some, so we're going to hear from Christina, Wayne Niederhauser, Lucas Ridd, and then Christina Oliver again. Right. Let's go ahead. Christina, you're going to talk about the current statewide housing funding data. I think Mr. Zara Niederhauser, you'll be talking about the permanent supportive housing. And then Lucas Ridd will talk about the Housing Preservation Fund. Christina, go.
So really quickly, I apologize, Jim Wood was not able to be here. So let me also add to that, we are working with the housing authorities in the state of Utah, thanks to Janice and Wayne co-chairing that particular side working group. That's a data source that we have never aggregated in the state of Utah. So what we're doing throughout the state is we're gathering all of this information. You're seeing the beginning stages of how we're going to be able to produce it for consumption. But again, it's very difficult to get all these data sets together. So part of the contract that we have with Kemp C. Gardner is providing a survey to the housing authorities, and we're going to be gathering more detailed data on household compositions, units that may not be deed restricted by a federal source or UHC or our office. And we're really going to try and provide as much of the universe of units and resources available. An interesting fact, I just want to point out, that there are a number of housing authorities right now that are not able to utilize their full vouchers. So if they authorized 100 vouchers, their budget from HUD is only, say, $50,000. They can only use maybe 50 of those vouchers. So we've got vouchers sitting out in the state that could be utilized, except for the budget from the feds does not provide us the amount of money that we need to cover the rent. So more detail to come. Wanted to talk a little bit about our marketing material, our pamphlet. Again, we're still collecting the universe of data on funding resources. We've run into a couple of roadblocks, which we are identifying. I don't believe that we will need any legislative changes to obtain data, but we are working on those, and we'll continue to identify any barriers that we come across. Wayne, do you want to take it away and talk a little bit about your 50 and 5 million?
Thank you. Yeah, sure. Just a little plug, though, on our effort in the funding group to bring the housing authorities into this discussion. This is the kind of collaboration that we need. The coordination with Utah Housing Corporation, HCD, the Office of Homeless Services, our housing authorities, we will be able to leverage more housing units if we're working together and we know what each other's doing. So this is a huge effort for us. We are now going to meet on a quarterly basis to talk about what is going on across the state, what's happening in HCD, Office of Homeless Services, with Utah Housing Corporation, trying to coordinate and collaborate the best we can. I believe this is a huge effort going forward. Christina highlights the problems with vouchers and, hey, you know, that's federal funding. And I remember Senator Lyle Hilliard always said, you live and if you live by the federal funds, you die by the federal funds. So, you know, we can't necessarily dictate what happens there, but we can deal with the issues at a local level. When I got into this position, and I've said this before, but I just need to say it again, I'm a real estate developer, CPA by profession. So I was always heavy into performance. How are we going to make this project work? What's it going to take? And I can tell you that deeply affordable workforce housing, 50-60%. The reason why we don't have units there, why there's such a deficit, it does not naturally attract capital. It never will, because you are so far underwater in these projects. If we're going to have those projects, we have to figure out how we're going to fund them. And you've seen the housing model we come up with. It's rent flow, it's vouchers, It's one-time funds like the Olney & Walker Fund and like the Deeply Affordable Housing Grants. Those are the one-time funds to fill the gaps that the low-income housing tax credit can't complete, or if there's just a gap in a housing project, or if we need to buy the AMI down from 50% to 30%, you need some one-time funds to be able to do that. Reduce the debt stack. There's a lot of ways to slice and dice that, but it all fits within that model, and those are the gaps that we face. So I think we need to. This has been confirmed today by the Kim Gardner presentation, and thanks Theon for that, and for and thanks to the legislature for giving us the direction to get this thing done, and HCD for getting it done. This is going to be vital information for us going forward. What we're going to probably come forward with is, again, some more one-time money for the Olney & Walker Fund, for the Deeply Affordable Housing Grants. We are right in the middle of getting our new tranche of money out. We've had almost $110 million. That is chasing after the $50 million that the legislature gave us. So we're going to have a similar outcome as we did last year. The attainable housing grants are the ongoing rent support, not as big a demand. So it's a little bit of a surprise for us, but I think there's some education that needs to happen, and we'll get more into that when we have final results. But those are the things that we're going to hope that the CHA will approve and that the UEOC will support in going forward to the legislature. And Dion's report today gives us all the data we need to really make a play and an argument that if we're going to address housing in Utah, it's going to take some appropriations. And I just want to say also that up until this last session, the state had very little ongoing commitment to housing. Housing probably top three issue in the state, if not top three, top five, if you were to ask people, housing, the cost of housing. And top three, and yet we had an ongoing commitment of $3 million. That's now up to almost probably $15 million. Well, with the $5 million, we're getting closer to $20 million. So, you know, we thank the legislature for that, but, you know, they just appropriated a $30 billion budget, almost $30 billion. And so, you know, we're not spending a lot on this most important issue in the state. And I just want to remind everybody that We just got the new data out on homelessness, and when I look at last year's data and the rates of homelessness across the country, you might guess that California is probably the highest, and you'd be right. At 44 people that are homeless in California per 10,000. And if you haven't heard this before, Mississippi is the lowest at 4 per 10,000. Utah's 11 per 10,000. But why is Mississippi so low? They have the lowest cost of housing in the country. Where's the housing the costliest? In California. They're 44. And you can almost draw a line. The cost of housing is a determinant of homelessness. And I think the data shows that and proves that. So anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairs.
Thank you. I had a note that you were going to talk about permanent supportive housing, which I didn't hear you mention. Did you want to talk about that specifically?
Permanent supportive housing. Well, I'll just say that when we do these grants, they have to come forward with an application that includes services. Because when we're talking about a homeless population, a persistent homeless population, and housing those individuals, putting them in housing and just leaving them there without any kind of support doesn't work. We are wasting our time. You have to have the supportive services with the housing. They go together. One does not work without another. And I'm just happy to emphasize that. But we are creating permanent supportive housing with our grant money that we received from the legislature.
Okay, thank you. Lucas Ritt, you're up next.
Great.
On housing preservation.
Great, thank you. Could I become
will you pull the mic a little bit
here?
Pull the mic closer to you if you
can. You hear me now?
Yes, better.
That's perfect. Could I become a presenter? I'll just go through my own slides if that's okay.
Sorry, she's pulling up your slides right now.
I have them up as well. So if I on Zoom, if she wants to just make me a presenter, be able to present, I can just do that as well. Maybe makes it a little simple. Thank you. Great. Well, first of all, thank you for allowing me to kind of share a little bit about the Utah Housing Preservation Fund and the impact that we have been able to make and what really this solution is about. The Utah Housing Preservation Fund has, you know, makes you ask the question, you know, what is housing preservation? I'm sure that most of you, you know, really know what generally many of these solutions to affordable housing are. But really focusing on why preservation as a strategy to fight affordable housing is a key piece. You know, I'll start with just the high level information. I know Dayan set the scene much better than I can, but really we have so many families here in Utah living on the edge. Car payments, you know, they're living in housing that is above their head, first of all. But second of all, you know, with one major financial crisis in their lives, it's going to be choosing between a job and where you're living, and then, you know, hopefully finding somewhere else that's more affordable, which, as we see, is less and less likely. But really, the focus on housing preservation as a strategy to fight affordable housing and to help solve the issue comes down to the fact that we have worked so hard already to create affordable housing across the state. Amazing programs like the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program. There's many, many deed-restricted units that are still deed-restricted in the pool. I just quickly updated a number right here. 4,600 units, though, in the next 5 years are going to be expiring from the deed restrictions. And if nothing's done, then those units most likely, because of, you know, we have the dollar incentive, the capitalistic incentive, is not to go keep those units affordable or take out more tax credits. It's more to sell that to the market, which sees Utah as a very valuable state to invest in right now. And they will just take those units to the market, they'll improve them, and all of those tenants will be pushed to the streets. Unfortunately, the rents will rise, usually to the tune of $300 to $500 per unit per month, which is unaffordable. And this is the process that's been repeated over and over again. And to solve it, really, we needed a specific group. We need a specific strategy. And that's what housing preservation as a strategy does. If there's a bucket of affordable housing, there's still a hole in the bottom. And while we pour plenty of new development, which is absolutely necessary for our state to thrive, into the top, we need to plug the hole in the bottom, at least to some degree, to make sure we're keeping the affordable housing that we paid so much and we worked so hard to create. In addition, housing preservation as a strategy works much, much faster than housing development. And it is much, much more cost effective than developing housing. Great programs, you know, provide from the state or the federal level on the low-income housing tax credit side make it possible for the market to create affordable housing. But as Wayne Niederhauser said, you know, it's hard on a if you're looking at a pro forma, you're looking at the numbers, the market does not have much of an incentive outside of programs like that to create affordable housing. The incentive is to take them away from affordable housing when it's available. So coming from that idea of what the housing preservation strategy does, I wanted to touch and dig into how the Utah Housing Preservation Fund works. common preservation funds are run throughout the country. And many of these preservation funds work based on some of the banks have needs for the Community Reinvestment Act to reinvest into their communities. But their levels tend to not really be focused on the impact and the AMI levels. They tend to skim the top. Usually it's 80% AMI at 51% or more of their units in a property, which does not really make an impact, as we know, as we almost have met a lot of the 80% AMI needs for the state. We need to have much more deeply affordable housing. And so when the Utah Housing Preservation Fund was formed, the idea was this is a middle market solution from 30% AMI to 80% AMI. This is the group that we can focus on to purchase this affordable housing that exists and keep it there instead of letting it completely go upwards of 80% AMI. The idea was not to have many other groups and other funds throughout the state to all try to kind of come at it at a slightly different angle, but to unify all of them and put them in, all of those that want to make an impact in that middle income, into one fund that's going to be able to do that. And just highlighting this picture here, this is from when the fund was announced and formed. You know, many of those are key impact investors to the Utah Housing Preservation Fund, Utah Nonprofit Housing Corporation, the Clark and Christine Ivory Foundation, the Miller Foundation, and of course the state and Intermountain Healthcare. This is, the fund is created to unify all these groups, foundations, CRA banks, and the state. And CRA banks, as to highlight, Utah is the fifth largest banking state in America. Of course, we don't represent that population-wise. We're not fifth. But for banking, we are, have a huge, huge support system, I guess you could say, when they come back and want to reinvest in our community. And so we're able to tap into that to make our impact. And then the key piece is we're stopping those that expire, those units that are expiring in the housing affordability. But not only that, we don't, it's impossible almost to track the naturally occurring affordable housing that's already there. So many units are dubbed in the private equity world as value add. And, you know, really in our world, it means it's an affordable unit that doesn't have a deed restriction yet. And so we need to protect those units more than anything else as well, because those units are the ones that go first and are already vulnerable to being purchased by a group that's going to bring them out of affordability. As a highlight too, the fund works through the partnership of these groups. We raise money not only through asking the state for grants and making, the key piece of the fund that was done the Utah way, not only is the cooperation, but leveling up the how this preservation fund works compared to others. Instead of choosing a 10-year timeline in which the fund is going to make an impact for 10 years and then we're going to sell those assets to another group, we've chosen to change the way the fund works. The way preservation funds work here in Utah, specifically ours, is to take a perpetual approach. The solution isn't going, or the problem is not going away, and neither should a solution. And so the Utah Housing Preservation Fund, when it purchases units, it creates a pool of affordable housing that should stay and last in our housing stock for affordability. And the way that's funded is through these three groups, the CRA banks that are looking to give back to the community and make as much of an impact as possible, foundations, which make impact investments and grants to the fund, as well as the state, which has made it all possible to be a perpetual fund through making grants to the fund. Here are some of our current contributors that are not the state. Intermountain Healthcare, Zions Bank, Larry H. Miller, Workers' Compensation Fund, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Square Bank, American Express, the Clark and Christine Ivory Foundation, Comenity, and the Eccles Foundation. There's many others that are also in the process of joining in because they see the impact that this fund makes. It's all about social impact. The mission is absolutely pure to make the impact that Utah needs in a preservation fund for the middle income levels. As context of how the fund works, I touched on the fact that we are evergreen. This is perpetual. This is anything that comes into the fund and is in excess of returning, making sure our properties function, goes back in to preserve more affordable housing and ensure the fund is perpetual. In addition to that, we've made our focus to make a geographical impact Dayan highlighted so well, that even though there's a need of affordable housing is met maybe at 80% AMI in one geographic area, across the counties, across the area of all of Utah, there's needs all throughout. And so the focus has been, let's make it 70% of our investments into urban areas, Wasatch Front, areas that have higher populations, as well as 30% into rural areas that have struggling needs like Moab or Summit County or Tooele, which, you know, maybe we don't consider as rural as it used to be, but it still has needs for affordable housing that are growing dramatically. And as our targets to make an impact on the area median income, they range from 30% up to 100%. However, at this time, the fund has only ever done deed restrictions at 80% or below, making sure that all of our units are affordable. To quickly highlight what has been done so far, our tenants currently save more than $5,000 a year on rent. In addition, we're serving almost 1,700 tenants. This aggregate is right now $3.2 million of rent savings to those in the fund units every year, and that will continue to grow as the fund is growing. We serve and partner with other nonprofits to impact refugees, veterans, and homeless families, and those help rapid rehousing of those families. 644 units are preserved at the moment, and our average area median income that we serve across all of our tenants is at 50%. And I wanted to highlight out the fund's commitment to housing affordability. I think that this number is wrong after seeing what Dayan just said. It seems like maybe I should have a zero at the end of this for the housing deficit, truly. And that just highlights out the need of affordable housing across the board. While we come in as a middle of the AMI scale or spectrum solution, groups, you know, Wayne Niederhauser's group focusing on the deeply affordable housing all the way up to the top are all extremely needed. We are here to be a team player, and the fund itself, as we'll continue to come to the legislature and ask for money in order to impact the affordable housing, and we want to do it as a team, as a group, making sure that we make an impact across all the entire spectrum of area median income. And I appreciate you guys' time. I'm open to any questions or thoughts you guys have.
Okay, thank you. I see a light on over here, but I don't know whose it is. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. So I had a question and then a comment. So the 4,600 units that are going to lose their rent, their income restriction in the next 5 years, are those tax credit units, or are they state and local funded units as well?
So I actually have a different number. I just stole that one from Dayan a little bit, so maybe he has a better answer for that. But at least my number was a little bit higher even than that, and it included not only tax credit deals, but also home fund deals that are expiring at the same time. So there's a couple different programs that would be mixed into that, but all of them with their deed restrictions completely expiring at that time.
Okay, thank you. And I guess this is my comment to the state and anybody who really funds affordable housing. Would it be possible to put language into the contracts or the land use that says that when they come to the term of their affordability compliance, that the first right of refusal should go to a nonprofit, such as the Housing Prevention or Preservation Fund or a housing authority or another nonprofit to have the option to purchase the property?
Thank you. We can talk with our attorneys about that, because okay, the tax credit deals have some overriding regulations. I'm not sure that we can do that. And then on Lucas's side of the house, there are other contractual obligations for those donated funds to pay for those projects. So it would take a bit of research.
I just think if we're investing, we should try to make sure that there's at least a intent to preserve.
Okay. We will look into it.
Okay, thank you.
Real quick thought on maybe what was said from Janice. Just really interesting thought process there. We were thinking through that same thing. We want to discuss that further. We'll have to make sure that that's talked through. But, you know, on UHC's side as well, I wanted to, you know, interesting idea of, I don't know if what restrictions in the QAP could be made, but maybe something even more just as an incentive to add, if they choose to make a first right of refusal or give first opportunity to a group that's going to keep it affordable, if that could be added in more generically. That's something that we'd love to get into further. So I appreciate you bringing that up, Janice, because that's something we've been exploring.
Thank you. I don't see any questions, any hands online, so thank you so much for the presentation. That's an important part of our of the housing affordability puzzle, is preserving what we've already got. All right. Next, we're going to hear from our policy working group. Chris Gambrulis is the chair there. First, we're going to hear from Christina Oliver on condominium financing, and then we'll hear from Chris on the subcommittee's work and discussion. Go ahead, Christina.
Thank you, Senator. So really quickly, we have a small group of individuals working on condo barriers to development and financing. And so it's not just the financing piece or the risk level for these particular units, but there are definite land use barriers, including certificate of occupancies and a lot of very nuanced, weedsy details that I have some of the best and brightest attorneys in the state that do these deals coming together, and we're going to outline those, and we'll be able to provide them to you.
That's good. I look forward to a proposal. It seems like legislative changes might be in order in, to remove the barriers to approve condominiums, which kind of serve as an entry point to home ownership, and that we really don't have in Utah. Thank you for that. Chris Gambrulis, we would look forward to hearing your report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity. Great presentations today, especially from Dayon and Lucas. Want to echo what Lucas said about the importance of that, preserving that housing stock. Because once it goes away, you just don't get it back. We've met several times, the policy group. We're digging in some more research. We've had some ideas that we've thrown out early on, like setback restrictions and parking requirements and those kinds of things. And we're digging in, doing some research on some of those ideas. The idea is really just legalizing missing middle housing and looking for opportunities where this missing middle housing works. And that can be small lot, small home, duplexes, triplexes, even condos, as you just said, Senator. What are some of the obstacles to that? Well, candidly, some of the obstacles are the things that go into the zoning requirements, like setbacks and parking restrictions that reduce, the yield on a particular property. And so we've been talking about some of the ideas around those. We're aware that the legislative auditor is doing some work, doing an audit. We're waiting for some numbers to come back and have their audit come back. But we know that they're looking at density numbers, minimum base densities. We need to pursue our water duty. And I'm looking at you, Representative White. I can see you on my screen. How are you? You co-sponsored a bill last year, Senate Bill 158, with Senator McCall, and we need to revisit that. And those are some of the big picture issues. There are some other things that will just take on a life of their own. For instance, on property tax transparency, and we know that there's a Senate sponsor that has been thinking about that quite a bit, and that will come back. So we're trying to bring the different parties together. We understand that there's going to be a lot of opinions at the table on some of these things. Some of them are going to be more difficult than others, but as we research some of these topics, we will come back with some language here and have some more hard proposals to share with you in the coming weeks.
Hard proposals, huh? Great.
Hard proposals, meaning they will not just be direct, but they will be difficult.
Thanks. A couple questions for you, Chris.
Yeah.
So in the media recently, certainly since we met, there's an article about a development in Lehigh where Ivory Homes was targeting to make some changes to that development so that they could build houses at the $450,000 price point. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So what we did is we retooled a product type that we had that we called our e-villas. So E, the letter E, hyphen villas. And we had a three-story product. So small lot, single family detached, more vertical, a little taller.
Garage on the bottom floor.
I'm sorry?
A garage on the bottom floor.
Garage on the bottom floor, yeah. Living area, bedrooms. Hard to do that kind of construction and design outside of master plan communities because you run into setback requirements and height restrictions because we're over 35 feet on those three-story. And we built them and they look great. They're beautiful. Then we said we could actually hit a lower price point if we took off one of these floors. So we retooled it, created a two bedroom, two bath option that's a two story, that we could sell, you know, a single family detached home at 450. So that's something that we did. And it took some time. But it only took a couple of months. Now, to be able to do that in just an infill site or something like that is much more difficult. But when you have the kind of flexibility that you have in a master plan community with a development agreement that gives you a lot of flexibility, you know, it's easier to pivot. And what we would like to see is to create. So that's a great question. I didn't even tee that up, but what I was saying before about setbacks and parking requirements, those kinds of things, as a developer and a builder, we have a lot of flexibility in those master plans, so we can adjust those kinds of things. But if it's just an infill location that's zoned RM12 or something like that, then you just don't have that kind of flexibility. So it's harder to do that. So what
you say, you don't have that flexibility.
You do not have that kind of flexibility.
Because the cities, like there's no city that would allow it or?
What happens with
the
these?
The code doesn't allow it.
It becomes the Euclidean part of zoning is that, you know, in a zone, a setback is established and a parking requirement is established.
But those are each, correct me if I'm wrong, those are each established by a municipality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Correct.
And are they fairly uniform statewide?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe fairly.
So a city could allow you to do that if the city chose to, and if that city's decision wasn't referred and repealed by voters, correct?
Yeah, and it didn't go through a long process. We didn't have to go ask permission to retool and change our setbacks in this master plan. We already have the flexibility to do that. One of the real cost drivers of housing is time. And if you have to pause and stop and go in and do a, as they say, a mother may I, it adds time and difficulty. So to your question though, Senator, Ivory Homes did do that. And I think that there are a lot of builders and developers who are thinking about how to retool to get to a lower price point. I think there are anecdotes about, well, they pushed up homes to make them bigger. It's probably, I'm not saying that that's not true, but there probably are just as many anecdotes of of examples of what we did and what we know other home builders and developers have done.
Which is push to make them smaller?
Push to make them smaller.
Okay. In Dion's presentation, I think he had a slide that's just like the number of units being added is going down. I assume that's largely because of interest rates, if that's true. What's your opinion on that?
Probably true.
It's interest rates on two sides, right? One, it makes the home much less affordable. So something that used to go for $500,000 is now, you know, would create a monthly payment of X, and now it's, I don't know, X plus 20%. So,
right.
So what you used to be able to sell at a price point is no longer affordable at a 30-year mortgage for a good chunk of the population. Is there also a high interest rate component on the builders because your capital is more expensive now?
No question. Absolutely.
And so you don't have access to the same amount of capital to be able to build projects.
It just doesn't go as far.
Okay, so then here's my question. I bought my first house at an 8.25% interest rate. And now I'm 48. And so this was, multiple decades ago. But this is not I drive down, I see the billboards, right? So interest rates now are around 6 to 6.5.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And those billboards change like every day.
Right.
So 6.5% is a lot less than I did.
Really good rate.
I wonder why we didn't have this problem 20 years ago if interest rates were higher then. And what's your opinion about that?
That is a really multifaceted question because you're also asking about buyer preferences and third car garages and gourmet kitchens and the things that buyers were able to afford under a lower interest rate versus today.
Sure.
And just those expectations. And so all of it, it's buyer preferences, it's lot sizes, it's home sizes, it's finishes. But I have the same experience as you buying a home at 8 or 9% interest and seeing a rate at 5 and thinking, wow, that went up. And it's really reset. In that same article, you probably saw where, Clark Ivory also said that, yeah, as interest rates were going up last year, things really slowed down. And this year they picked back up again, even though interest rates were sticky. And I think people are getting more and more used to those. But it's, you know, people buy what they can afford to pay on a monthly basis.
Right.
It is that month that drives things a lot. I'll give you just an example of how important it is to keep prices down. We're looking at, you know, even HOA fees, which go into your mortgage. They have to be counted in because they're collected as part of your mortgage. For a $40 per month HOA fee is a $7,000, you reduce your buying power by $7,000.
Right.
So if you can afford a $450,000 home, that same home today is $443. Because you can just not.
And that's at a $30
a month? $40 a month.
Are there any HOAs that charge $40 a month?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, I mean, they don't have big amenities and stuff, certainly.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, they go from 100 to 140. You can see how that changes dramatically a buyer's buying power.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chris. Are there any? I don't see any further questions there. Nothing online. So thank you for your time. I'm going to ask. I asked you a few questions and let you have a go. I want to see if there's anybody from your subcommittee that wants to address us at all.
Senator, this is Steve Waldrop.
Okay, Steve.
I've had that same question there, and I probably there's several people in that room there that would be able to pull out a graph. One of the biggest components I think of housing costs or, you know, unaffordability is the gap between housing costs and wages over the last, if you look at a graph over the last 10 years, I think housing costs have, you know, doubled and wages have gone up, you know, 50%. If you go back 40 or 50 years, you know, the gap gets greater and greater. So if you were, you know, if you were to draw a graph, you know, and pick a starting point, say 1980, and that was where you started with home prices and wages, and then you plotted out from there the increase in home prices relative to the increase in wages, you would see that gap growing more and more dramatic over time. I'm not sure, Chris, that I heard you talk about that, but that's one of the key components to, in my mind, to what we're dealing with now. So interest rates are, you know, certainly a component in the moment as they rise and fall, but writ large, the problem, you know, is a one that has gone on for many, many years as home prices have outstripped wage growth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you. All right, thank you. Next item on our agenda was a data update, but we really already had that. I'm going to take a – is this a public comment? All right, go ahead.
Can you hear me all right?
I can.
My name is Carson Eilers. I'm the policy director with the Utah Cities and Towns. I'm on the policy work group, and I just wanted to add a little bit of clarity to the master plan community difference versus a maybe traditional Euclidean neighborhood. And the conversation's being had there, but I just want to add one note that one of the differences you'll have in a master plan community is you're planning the infrastructure around this to accommodate it, right? So whether it's transportation, whether it's water lines, whether it's sewer lines, the city and sometimes the developer of the agreement are working together to figure out a solution that can kind of form this unique community that won't disrupt other infrastructure systems and trying to accommodate some character. Where traditional neighborhoods where you run into issues oftentimes with setbacks is whether you have, say, pipes in the front yard attaching from the rear. So you have some aesthetic preferences from neighbors that you have to deal with, but you also have some real infrastructure issues when you're trying to do an infill project like Chris was talking about that makes setbacks almost less a preference and more of a cost barrier or some really complicated system that you have to figure out how to make that work with some kind of unique style of
sure, because you have existing infrastructure.
Yeah.
And so you need to either, you know, do something that's compatible and workable with the existing infrastructure or replace all the infrastructure. And what, you know, if the goal is to make it more affordable, replacing all the infrastructure makes it less affordable.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or impossible. Okay.
So I just wanted to add that one note.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I asked a lot of questions about that. I hope that I didn't come across pejorative, but thank you for coming and sharing that.
Not at all. Thank you.
Okay. And we have a question. Is that Janice again?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Actually, not a question, Senator. Bert is here, and we still had part of our data presentation.
Okay.
So.
Fair enough.
On the GIS.
All right. Come on up. Appreciate it. Okay, Bert from WFRC, we look forward to your presentation.
That is me.
We're going to have some looks from our data working group, which I appreciate. And thank you, Janice.
Okay, and I just thank you for having me, Bert Granberg with Wasatch Front Regional Council. I just need to know how to share my screen. If I could get a – should I do that through Zoom? I'm set up to do that. Wow, there it is. Fantastic. So again, thank you for having me. I'm going to talk a little bit about housing accessibility tools. This is a topic that we picked up as a subgroup of the data working group and show some examples. But first thing I want to do is I want to just address this the topic of accessibility and housing, which accessibility is really important when thinking about locating a household or building new houses. And, you know, ideally we're building new houses in areas that are highly accessible, that have a great number of access to opportunities. And that accessibility or access to opportunities includes three primary factors: transportation choices, the options to drive, ride, walk, or work virtually, for example, mobility, how fast we can travel in space, and then very importantly, proximity, the third factor, how far we are from the things that we need in our daily life. So those three things, choice, mobility, and proximity, come together into this concept of accessibility, the ease with which we can reach important destinations in our life. And just a real quick graphic, I'm actually going to move through these slides pretty quickly, but for housing accessibility, location really matters to residents. It greatly impacts the amount of time they need to spend to accomplish the important things in their life. So how can we better see the landscape of housing accessibility? We looked at two map-based tools that have been put together in the past year. The first one I'm going to talk about and show some examples from is the Wasatch Front Housing Access to Opportunity tool that WFRC put together with partners. But another effort that's noteworthy was an interactive map that Salt Lake County Housing Trust Fund put together to prioritize projects in the Salt Lake County area. So we were looking at both of these, and I'm going to dive into the one on the left. So I think everyone on the data work group and the subgroup on housing accessibility felt that a map-based housing accessibility tool is important to decision-making, both at an individual household level and a regional or statewide level. And the tool that we sort of kind of framed, and it just happened that we had a prototype that was built and working, was this idea that you should be able to see the landscape within a community that you're interested in. You should be able to see a number of different important layers, geographic data layers that show access to the workplace and also access to key community amenities. And that you should also, as a user of a tool, you should be able to basically like use your own values with the tool. So it's not giving you a canned answer. It's letting you pick what's important to you in terms of criteria and weighting, and then have the landscape of accessibility shown in the map be recalculated on the fly. And here's some of the map layers that were put to work in both of the examples: transit, parks and open space, access to the freeway system, schools, community centers, healthcare, education, groceries. Those are the types of things that an accessibility tool should be considering when it's looking at housing site selection. And just a couple of examples of the data layer that's available at a region or state level. Here we're looking at, on the left side, jobs within a typical commute from a driving perspective. We're looking here at the southern part of Salt Lake County into Utah County. So the left is auto jobs within a typical commute by car. On the right side, jobs within a typical commute using the transit system. So these are things that are important in terms of housing accessibility. Drawing from that long list of other possible layers of interest, this map is showing childcare centers, and this is a statewide data set, and sort of doing a simple time buffer around locations in the state's childcare database. And here's another statewide layer, grocery stores, and sort of a drive time buffer around those as well. So what the tool that we built for the Wasatch Front does is it lets you pick your criteria. So there's a short list of community necessities, and in this example that I'm going to show you in a second, we've set the priority for childcare as high, we've set the priority for groceries as high, and also a 10-minute walk to parks as high. And then in the access to employment, we've set a medium priority for auto access to employment and a high priority for transit access. And then similar priorities for access to infrastructure in the immediate area of the home. So having set those custom criteria, the map redraws and it shows you sort of a ranking of the different areas of the region according to their level of accessibility and proximity to all the amenities from jobs to things like childcare and grocery stores. And then the last thing I'll note about the tool is it lets you click on any location of interest on the map, and it will show you sort of the detailed breakdown of the criteria that you've selected. Okay, so a quick sort of overview of the tool.
Hang on, I think we had a question.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, Bert, if you mentioned this, could you reiterate what areas you have built this map for?
Yeah. So this map is built for the WFRC and MAG Metropolitan Planning Organization area. So that is essentially Brigham City to Santaquin, so the Wasatch Front.
Okay, and then just a quick follow-up on that. I wanted to point out that the reason we think this is an important tool, yeah, the data set that Dayan presented to us earlier, historically with the moderate income housing plan, each municipality that's required to report has to target a specific count of units that they're going to increase. Dayan already presented to us today that there is about equal number of 80% AMI units available to that particular income level. If you'll recall, our moderate income housing plan requests municipalities to hit the 80% AMI. So that is something that they are working on actively. But as we look at strategic funding for below 80%, the reason why we believe collectively this map is so important is because we want to ensure that we're setting up those lower income households for success by having access to these variable amenities. So thanks, Bert.
Okay, this is my last slide. I'll just say that the committee, the work group sort of thought about next steps to consider. We could build on this existing map of the Wasatch Front, potentially expand its geographic coverage to other fast-growing areas of the state or potentially statewide. If you're going to have a tool like this, it's important to make sure you've got all the layers that are relevant and to keep them current. And then there probably are some tweaks that could be made to further align a tool like this its alignment to policy interests. So helping folks to either select, ideal places to live or to build or invest in new affordable housing, or even looking at where there are important gaps in services or amenities or employment in the region and better understanding that. And that, with that, I'll conclude and see if there are additional questions. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Sorry, we have been having a sidebar about how this has solved all of our problems. So that was actually really great to see. I appreciate, the work that has gone into that, I really hope will help the cities in planning out where they want housing to go in order to be the most impactful. And it seems like the great advantage of something like this is you can use a map to be able to see, let's assume that housing, even if housing costs are constant, we can do things at the margins to make other things less expensive by how and where we put places. That makes housing more affordable by making other things cost less. But anyway, so thank you so much. Okay, we've reached the end of our agenda, except it says other business. Does anybody have anything to bring up for the good of the order? Then I will take a motion to tell me when our next meeting is. September 5th. And when is our next UEOC meeting? August 30th. Thank you. Thank you. To the gallery. So today is Stacy's last day with us. Thank you, Stacy. We will miss you and hope your next pasture is greener. Right? Thank you. I'm not saying this one, I'm just like, hey, move on to a wonderful future. So thank you. I will now take a motion from Representative White. He moves to adjourn. That's non-debatable. All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed say no. All right. That motion passes. We are adjourned.